You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluid?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, if you're a longtime listener, this isn't going to surprise you, but maybe you just joined me like a couple episodes ago. We talk about sexual health and wellness, pleasure. We talk about relationships, identity, politics, and justice. And today, I just want to give you a content alert that there's not going to be much sex today. There might not be any sex, but given the times that we are living in right now, I really feel like this is an important conversation to have. And it definitely is in conversation with other guests I've had on the show. So I hope you'll stick around and there'll be sex next week. Okay, cool. Let me introduce to my guest. Jordan Flaherty is an award-winning journalist, producer, and author. He has appeared as a guest on a wide range of television and radio shows. He's the author of the books No More Heroes, Grassroots Responses to the Savior Mentality, and Floodlines, Community and Resistance from Katrina to the Gen 6, and has produced television documentaries and news reports for Democracy Now!, Telesur, The Laura Flanders Show, and Al Jazeera, including as a producer on the Emmy, Peabody, and DuPont award-winning program Fault Lines on Al Jazeera. His print journalism has been featured in dozens of major publications around the world. He also produces award-winning fiction films, documentaries, music videos, news reports, and his reporting and analysis has also been published in several anthologies. He produced the fiction film Chocolate Babies, which won Best Picture Awards at South by Southwest and the New York Gay and Lesbian Film Festival. And he's an all-around veteran activist and journalist who I can't wait to hear from. I can't wait. So welcome to Sex Out Loud, Jordan.
Thank you. I'm so thrilled to be here on one of my favorite podcasts.
Oh my God, that's so sweet. So I like to start out by asking a question that is slightly related to what we're going to talk about. Your book is about savior mentality. And I want to know, what is something you've saved a lot of?
You know, I am too much of a pack rat. I think I have too many. I would say I still have t-shirts from when I was like 16 years old, and not all the listeners know this, but I'm around Tristan's age, and I have trouble throwing out clothes. I think I don't like buy a lot of clothes, but I just keep them.
You keep them. Also, those can be sold for hundreds of dollars. Whenever I go to like Echo Park and I see a Cure tour shirt, which I had like every Cure tour shirt there was, but I somehow lost them along the way, I'm like, wow, I could be making $200 on that one t-shirt.
Is that really true? Because I definitely have a Cure tour shirt from like 88.
Okay, that's definitely true. So, I mean, maybe we can work something out because you're not in LA anymore. So you have to send them to me and I get a cut. But no. Okay, so we're going to talk about your book, No More Heroes, Grassroots Response Mentality. I mean, this book feels very timely, even though you wrote it and it was published 4 years ago. It absolutely belongs on the reading list of so many folks, especially people who have been newly ignited to learn about white supremacy, racism, anti-racism work. So if you guys are all buying White Fragility, meaning white people, you should get this book too. That's what I think. So you lay out lots of examples of this concept of white savior mentality. Let's start by just describing what that is.
Yeah, and you know, I want to start also by saying that I don't consider myself like an expert. I don't do anti-racism trainings. I don't want to think of myself as an expert, but I have been doing journalism on these issues for a number of years. And I saw these kind of common themes coming up in movements when I was doing journalism. And I think taking the lesson, you know, going back to like Stokely Carmichael in the civil rights movement, where he said like white people need to be like organizing other white people, I tried to talk about journalism where I'm, you know, talking about ways that myself and other white folks are falling into these patterns, like the savior mentality. And so I've been really lucky that I've gotten to talk to really amazing, brilliant people as a journalist, I think have great things to say. And so folks like Caitlin Breedlove of Southerners on New Ground and Alicia Garza, one of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter movement, and Monica Jones, who's a Black trans woman who was arrested for walking while trans and does sex work activism. And so I feel like I got to learn from a lot of these folks about how they'd seen the savior mentality pop up. And so as this common theme, you know, for me, when I say it, I mean two things. One, this like great man theory of history, this idea that history is shaped by individuals instead of movements, like that the civil rights movement is just MLK or JFK or some other set of three letters, LBJ, or, you know, that Lincoln is responsible for the gains of ending slavery, right? And ignoring the thousands and millions of especially working class Black people that fought and died for these rights and fought in these movements. And I think it's a really disempowering view when we think of it as individuals rather than movements. And also this idea that I think especially we white folks are brought up with, that communities being helped don't need or deserve to be consulted, that we can just go in and just kind of by being white, we're the experts and we just can kind of go into any community and tell people what we need, what they need. And I think it's so backed up by the culture around us. You know, in all these movies, we see these white saviors come in and they're always the expert in these communities, the kind of Dances with Wolves meets every like, you know, white teacher savior movie that you ever saw, where she, you know, usually white woman teacher saves like the Black inner school kids. You know, we just see this story over and over again. I think we start to internalize it. So that's what I mean when I say the savior mentality.
And of course, it has its roots in the beginning of white people coming to America. I mean, it has its roots in settler colonialism and Christianity. Because white people came over here not just for a land grab, but also they believed that they could reprogram indigenous folks. That was kind of the whole project of the boarding schools, that we knew better, that just that the that's the assumption. We know better and we need to teach these other people who always are brown and Black what they don't know.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot about Andrea Smith in her amazing book, Conquest, where she talks about how sexual violence and colonialism have always gone together, and specifically putting in these patriarchal rules and divisions of gender were a key part of colonialism and of the colonialist project.
Yeah, so it feels like it's kind of baked into our DNA in really problematic ways. Like you said, we're like soaking in it, so we don't necessarily always see it.
Yeah, it's in our school system. It's in our movies. You know, I say also in the book, like Batman is the ultimate savior hero. He's like this rich person that he really could solve things by giving away all his money, but instead he solves it by like making a Batmobile and like a bat belt. And we're supposed to think that like that's really what rich people can do to save.
And that also he's the only one who can do it.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
He often doesn't like join forces with other superheroes.
Yeah.
It's just him. It's just the lone guy showing up in the car.
Another story that I tell in the book comes from Mario Van Peebles, who, when his father made the film Panther about the Black Panther Party, and I think it was the 90s, he said, one of the studio heads suggested that we make one of the leading Panthers a white man. And another studio had suggested, another suggested focusing on a Berkeley white person who would meet five young black guys, teach them to read and stand up for themselves, and then they become the Panthers. Like, that's literally what Hollywood imagined this story to be. And, you know, it's amazing, you know, we still don't, like, there still hasn't really been much film story of the, you know, stories like the Black Panthers. I actually just recently saw this film, Seberg, which I think the story of Jean Seberg is interesting. She's like this Hollywood actress who was really close with Panthers and gave them a lot of money. But this movie came out this year. It makes, actually, they invent a character, you know, they're telling the true story of Jean Seberg, and they invent a character of a sympathetic white FBI agent who is like really on her side. Like, they you see these movies, they like, in, even when it's like a real life story, they have to like invent this good white person that didn't exist and like put them in there. It's incredible.
Yeah, it's really problematic. I love this quote, which you have from Berkeley Carnine, who's talking about working with indigenous folks and doing a lot of activism. I'm going to read it here. Carnine often sees a pattern among non-indigenous volunteers. They're confronted with the deep injustice of Native American genocide and don't know how to deal with those feelings. That produces guilt and shame, which then trigger another set of emotions. I'm feeling bad, and I want to be able to take some action and alleviate that bad feeling. So then the goal becomes not alleviating suffering for others, but alleviating one's own suffering. I feel like that's like part of the key that we all have to kind of examine as white people in ourselves, right? Is the guilt fueling this, and am I just trying to make myself feel better? Because if you are, that's not, first of all, it's not what's needed. Right. So don't bother. And it's not really focusing on the real problems and inequities in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah. And Berkeley and Berkeley's sibling, Leah Jo, is also involved in showing up for racial justice and doing great work as well. And I think that quote lines up really well with white fragility, too, in this way in which we end up centering ourselves, even when we're trying to do anti-racist work, that this sense, this like fragility ends up centering ourselves.
Right, right. You know, white saviors often begin with good intentions, right? You know, Batman wants to make the city safer, save people from bad guys. And I think people want to help. You know, there are white people out there who want to do good in the world and who want to assist those less fortunate, who actually do want to take part in ending suffering. So, and you illustrate this really beautifully with things as simple as food banks. And then you also talk about Teach for America, the flood of young white activists to New Orleans post-Katrina, Project Rose, which is an anti-sex trafficking organization. So we're going to take a break, but my question for you after the break is, if it starts with good intentions, where does it all go wrong? Let's take a break. Hear from our sponsors. They're paying for the show. And when we come back, more with Jordan Flaherty. Sleep. We all love it, and most of us probably want more of it. But rather than getting a solid night's rest, we often find ourselves scrolling social media or reading the news when we should be powering down for the night. How many of you are guilty of that? I know I am. And it seems like lots of people in my social media feeds are struggling with insomnia. I've been using Calm, the app designed to help you ease stress and get the best sleep of your life. When I wake up after a good night's sleep, I feel like I can take on the world. Calm has a whole library of programs designed for healthy sleep, like soundscapes, guided meditations, and over 100 sleep stories, narrated by voices like Stephen Fry, Kelly Rowland, Laura Dern, even Harry Styles. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and get better sleep. For listeners of this show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's hundreds of hours of programming, Calm's entire library, and new content added every week. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan for 40% off a premium subscription. That's calm.com, calm.com/TRISTAN. I want you to have better sleep. y'all. It's pretty difficult to talk about things other than what's going on in our world right now. So delivering these ads to you are tricky for me, and I want to be transparent and honest about that. But also, these advertisers make it possible for us to do the show. And I believe in the ability of this show to help people. I don't consider pleasure something extra or frivolous or unnecessary right now. It is absolutely a part of resistance, justice, and freedom. One of our advertisers is Uber Lube. They make a great body-safe silicone lube with only two ingredients, silicone and vitamin E. No additives like parabens, preservatives, or petrochemicals. It's great for all kinds of sex play. Uber Lube adds a thin layer that leads to just the right amount of slip while still allowing for skin-on-skin sensations. If you need some lube, they're offering Sex Out Loud listeners a special offer. 10% off and free shipping when you use my code Tristan at uberlube.com. That's 10% off and free shipping. Just use the code Tristan at uberlube.com. Uber Lube lets you feel what you want to feel. You may have noticed the flowers are blooming, the grass is growing, and it's time to mow your lawn. Thanks to our sponsor, Manscaped, you can trim the hedges below the belt safely and efficiently. You know I don't like to beat around the bush, so I won't. Everyone could use a little trim of their pubic hair. Manscaped, the only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming, is here to make sure your balls, people with balls, are smooth and smelling nice. After all, it's time for some spring and, let's face it, summer cleaning. I actually like to do grooming with a partner. I find it really sexy, but I've used razors before and I'm always afraid to nick their genitals. Scary. You have to use the right tools for the job. When I use the Manscaped Lawnmower 3.0, I know it's safe and it always does a great job. The Perfect Package 3.0 kit comes with the lawnmower, the waterproof cordless body trimmer, anti-chafing ball deodorant and moisturizer, and the crop reviver to round out your manscaping routine. This third generation trimmer features a cutting-edge ceramic blade to reduce manscaping accidents. Millions of balls are about to be nick-free thanks to Manscaped advanced skin-safe technology. Subscribe to the Perfect Package and get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months. For a limited time, subscribers get two free gifts: the Shed Travel Bag, a $39 value, and the patented high-performance reduced chafing Manscaped Boxer Briefs. You should really try this out, and I've got a deal for you to get started. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code Tristan at manscaped.com. That's right, go to manscaped.com and get 20% off with free shipping when you use the code Tristan. Your balls will thank you. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Today I'm talking with award-winning journalist, producer, and author Jordan Flaherty about his book, No More Heroes: Grassroots Responses to the Savior Mentality. So I set you up for this big question before the break, about how often saviorism begins with good intentions and then it goes horribly wrong. And you have countless examples of this in your book. How does it all go wrong?
You know, I really think the simplest answer is capitalism, but you know, to go more into detail on it, I'm really indebted to the work of Insight Women of Color Against Violence and their book, The Revolution Will Not Be Funded. And they talk about how our movements are oriented towards funders instead of the people that are being served. And you know, you gave that example of soup kitchens and projects like that. And I always have trouble putting this in a short way, but really briefly, if you look at the foundation world, there's a lot of quote liberal money, but so much of that money goes towards funding organizations like soup kitchens that are doing work that the state should be doing. That's like, that's providing food, that's providing shelter, that's providing clothing. And so in some ways it actually is furthering a conservative agenda, because the conservative agenda is the state should not be helping people. It should just be a private thing. And so you end up with a lot of liberal money going to support what is a conservative agenda. I mean, remember, the first President Bush started the 1,000 points of light program. And basically that program was like, there will be all these thousands of points of light that will be private people that will be doing all the things that we used to think the government might do, right? And that's the conservative agenda, or, you know, put it in more rough terms, is one of Bush 2's advisors said, you know, we want to make government so small that you could drown it in a bathtub. And you know, that's
which this, really just, you know, yeah, echoes on so many levels. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. So that is this agenda. And I think that people, you know, when we come into these movements, we're already raised in white supremacy. We're raised in this competition mindset. And, you know, I also, in the book, I quote Jay-Z, which people might not have expected, but he says, to some degree, charity is a racket in a capitalist system, a way of making our obligations to each other optional and of keeping poor people feeling a sense of indebtedness to the rich, even if the rich spend every other day exploiting those same people, right? So this nonprofit system is set up that way. And if we want to, I think we're taught, you know, that if you want to do good work, you have to like get a job doing it, you know, that it's not our responsibility to fill our lives with, but you have to like work for Red Cross or work for United Way. And that's the way we do good. And, you know, I think our sense of how civic responsibility works is even twisted. And so, you know, getting back a little bit more to your question, I think in the book, I try to not say it's the fault of individuals. It, you know, it's the fault of this system. And so I'm not pointing fingers at someone, you know, saying you're working at a soup kitchen, you're a bad person, you're doing something wrong. Like, that's great. Like, that's great that you want to do that. And that's great that you want to help people. And I'm sure you are helping people in your life. But if we're not also challenging this system, you know, that those problems are going to persist. And that's why I also, I think, lift up the work of the Black Panther Party and their survival programs, right? And how they were providing food to people, but they were also challenging the state while doing it and saying, this is something the state should be doing. And so we're mounting a challenge to the state while doing it, right? And that's why J. Edgar Hoover of the FBI said that they were the biggest domestic threat to the US, because they were doing these programs in a way that was challenging the state. And so how can we help people, but also like challenge these systems that are putting people in a bad system instead of just upholding those systems?
Right. I mean, so I think the food bank and the soup kitchen thing is such a good example. Instead of that, you know, if people say, you know, in our city, hunger and the need for food distribution has gone up, so I think we need to open another soup kitchen or two. And that just reinforces the structure, right? No one stops and says, wait, how are we living in a first world country and people are starving? How are we living with a tremendous abundance of food and money and resources and people aren't getting this basic need met? Instead of sort of questioning the bigger picture, it's like, right, another soup kitchen, that'll help it. But it feels like a Band-Aid.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, I also think about there's the organization Generation Five, and their mission is ending childhood sexual abuse within five generations, right? And I think that kind of vision of saying, like, we're not just like fighting this problem, but we're envisioning how will this problem not exist in a certain amount of time? Like, how will we not have soup kitchens because everyone will be fed in, you know, in 10 years, in 20 years? I mean, I'd like to see it like tomorrow, right? But as soon as possible, how can we, instead of saying, and I think so many nonprofits, they're like, you know, what's our 30-year vision? We're going to be continue doing this. Like, and instead, too few nonprofits are like, how can we make ourselves like not have to exist in 10 years because we've actually changed the system. And so everybody has housing, everybody has food, everyone has, you know, drug treatment, everyone has what they need.
Yes. And this also brings up another point, which is, you know, one of the things that I found so disturbing is that celebrities have been donating to kind of COVID-19 like crisis funds, right? And I know that probably makes them feel better and maybe it, you know, garners them some goodwill, but I feel like it masks how poorly the government is actually doing. Like, private citizens should not be funding personal protection equipment. They should not be funding research. They should not be funding safety nets for those affected. And you write in the book, quote, "I don't believe you can get rich while doing good. Wealth and justice are mutually exclusive." Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, it's certainly this conflict that we're all put in this system of you know, how are we making a living? How are we doing well? But yeah, it's exactly as you say. Like I think celebrities trying to greenwash or however wash their money by putting them into these organizations. And again, I also don't blame them, but particularly, but yeah, I think also there's very few people telling celebrities where to put their money into. And so they have a publicist that's telling them to put it into the least controversial thing. And I think we've actually, you know, to not stay on the bleak level, I think we've seen this moment right now where you've seen a lot of celebrities in these last 2 months give monies to much more progressive causes, to these bail funds, which is a little bit, or just, you know, straight up Black Lives Matter organizations. You've seen more of them out in the streets. And I think, I do think that we're in a really exciting moment, Tristan. Like, I think, you know, I think things are shifting in really exciting ways.
So one thing that you do in this book, which I think like bears saying, is you show us these clear examples of white saviors in pop culture, in politics, in worldwide events, but you also offer what you call grassroots challenges to them. Why is it important to do both?
Yeah, I mean, because I wanted to show, I didn't want this to just be about problems, because I think that, like, as white folks especially, we can get so hung up on being afraid to do the wrong thing that we do nothing. And I think that is a problem as well. And, you know, I quote the Zapatistas who say, walking, we ask questions. And I think there's a few different interpretations of that. But you know, one way that I like to think about that is that, like, that we should be taking action, but we should be asking questions so we're taking action, so we're ready to change direction as we take that action. And so I want to really lift up, you know, for example, in the book, one of the folks I talk about is these Teach for America volunteers that came to New Orleans. And living in New Orleans post-Katrina, you know, you had all these systems going through this neoliberal takeover all at once. You had the public housing being torn down. You had the entire staff of the school system literally fired overnight, like 7,000 teachers, lunchroom workers, everyone was fired. It was the largest union in the city. It was mostly African-American women, and they were all fired, and they were replaced with these Teach for America volunteers. And so you had these young white folks that were idealistic and were told that they were going to be, you know, doing great things. They were told they would be, quote, greeted as liberators, if I can make a comparison there, right? And then they come into the city, and then they find that they were actually, like, replacing these African-American women who were displaced and fired and who had tenure and who had experience and who were doing really great work and, like, teaching these young people from these communities and had these deep connections to the communities and to the kids and to their families. And I talk about how these, you know, Teach for America volunteers, they could have just sort of ignored the context they were brought in and done the best they could, or they could have just walked away. And instead, what they did, which I think is really great, is they went and talked to these teachers that they were displacing, and they went and talked to the teachers' union. They said, "We realize we've been brought into this bad situation. How can we make up for it? You know, what do you want us to do?" And they said, "You know, you can organize against Teach for America from the inside." And so, you know, they, I think they turned this problematic role that they had fallen into, into a way to instead, like, fight for justice within that situation.
Yeah. Yeah. Which speaks to my next question, which is, like, what are some solutions and alternatives to white saviorism?
You know, well, one is just, like, I think thinking about this culture that we're in, and, you know, I quote Walida Emerisha, who's an amazing writer and co-author of Octavia's Brood. And she said, "Whenever we try to envision a world without war, without violence, without prisons, without capitalism, we're engaging in an exercise of speculative fiction. Organizers and activists struggle tirelessly to create and envision another world or many other worlds just as science fiction does. And I love that thought, like this idea that organizers are also science fiction writers, right? If you're out in the streets saying defund police, you're a science fiction writer, right? You're like envisioning this world that it's so hard for any of us to imagine. Like what does that world like without police look like? And so in some ways, like our greatest science fiction creators of this moment are the people out in the streets saying defund the police. And you know, I think going along with that, and back to sort of what I said before about like the Black Panther and their survival breakfast programs, like thinking about what are, as the French philosopher André Gorz said, what are non-reformist reforms? So what are ways that we can help people in this immediate moment, but we're also like challenging the system that's putting them in this bad place? What's a way that we can fight for dual power, like contesting for state power to change things on a mass level, while also like building up alternatives, building up community spaces, community organizations that are of the people that are representing the people? So how can we fight on these multiple levels at once? I think those are at least the questions to ask ourselves when we go into this.
And you also point out and make a great argument for listening,
yeah.
Which white people sometimes have trouble doing, which is like, if you are going into a community that is not your own, the first thing you have to do is listen to the folks in that community about what they want and about what they need. Because often I think we make assumptions, right? We make assumptions about what, quote, disadvantaged people need. And we act on those and we ignore that there are already movements, systems, communities in place doing work that we could amplify, that we could give money to. You know what I mean? We're like trying to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. And again, you know, New Orleans is this context that I've been in a lot. And you know, I remember, especially in this post-Katrina period, right? Like it was such an intense time to be here. And you had thousands of these really idealistic young white volunteers flooding into the city after the floodwaters, you know, went back. And I remember hearing these young white volunteers say, you know, we're bringing organizing to New Orleans. We're teaching New Orleanians about organizing. And New Orleans, for people that, you know, that know this history, there's this incredible history of Black-led organizing against white supremacy that goes back centuries. You know, you had communities of freed Black people in the 1730s here. And since that time, you have had, you know, free and enslaved people fighting against white supremacy and organizing against white supremacy. And to be, you know, a 20-year-old white person coming into this context and be like, we're going to show people what organizing is. You know, this way in which we are ignorant of the history of especially, you know, people of color and people of color movements and use that ignorance as a badge and as saying like we have this knowledge that we don't have because we have this shield of whiteness is so dangerous. Exciting.
Hey, but you know what this makes me think of? When I first came back to porn and said I want this to be more of a part of my work, I had a bunch of ideas from the sex positive movement and world about kind of what was wrong with porn, especially in terms of the production. And so I remember thinking, okay, so what do porn stars actually want? Like, what would improve their work experience? And I was like, vibrators, real orgasms, safer sex, a really respectful environment, verbal consent. Now, all those things are really important, just so you know. Those are all really good things that porn stars do want. But when I asked porn stars in casual conversations, hey, if you could fix one thing, if you could change one thing, or what makes a great day on the set, do you know what they told me?
Fair working conditions.
I get paid.
Yeah.
They said the check doesn't bounce, mm-hmm. and I get it that day or shortly thereafter.
And I think you make some of that point in the feminist porn book. And I remember mm-hmm. seeing that because I think, yeah, I had this idea, you know, of like what feminist porn is and that it was, you know, and that it had something to do with like the content. And I think that you, like, I really got that from you, this idea that feminist porn is about, like, the conditions of the workers. And like you said, people getting paid and people getting, people having their workers' rights respected. I'm paraphrasing your work, but is that accurate?
Yeah, no, it is about labor conditions and about labor, which of course feminism has always been concerned with. But it was like a wake up call to me, because I was like, oh, I know what it is. I know what it is. And then when you ask people, it's like, I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to be harmed.
Yeah.
And I want to get paid. And it's much different when you're on the outside. You just don't know. You don't know. And you have to go in with some humility and say, really, what is important to these folks? And it's like getting paid and getting paid their rate, not being, you know, not bargaining anyone down, which certainly has increased in the age of tube sites and all of that stuff. You do talk about some sex worker movements in this book. There's been a huge influx of anti-sex trafficking legislation, task forces, nonprofits, rescue missions. And I knew this before reading your book, but you show very clear examples of how the people who are trying to help actually are harming, or at the very least not benefiting, the folks they're trying to save, the sex workers themselves. You have a lot of firsthand accounts about how increased policing and criminalization leads to more arrests, more poverty, and more danger for sex workers. So I think this is another point that you drive home in the book, which is we've got to listen to the people who have the most at stake, or we have to listen to the most disenfranchised people rather than kind of override and tell them what they need, which I think has been going on since the beginning with sex workers.
Yeah, I mean, the Young Women's Empowerment Project in Chicago, who was working with minors that were doing sex work, right? And they surveyed these minors and they found, like, the vast majority, like, where they faced violence, where they faced threats, where they faced assault. And it was overwhelmingly from police, right? That was the biggest threat to their safety. These people that we think, you know, that we're told are rescuing them, you know, rescuing minors, right? Because minors, there's this societal agreement, right? That minors and sex work need to be rescued, that they're like not the criminals, that they're the victims, right? But still, they actually, by police, get treated as the criminals, because mm-hmm. police treat everyone they come into contact with, and especially all people of color, right? They treat them as the criminals, right? That's what the tool of policing is for. And that organization had to even stop existing as an organization that was even trying to help women that were doing sex work. These anti-trafficking laws would make that organization illegal, right? And the people working for that organization could be prosecuted. And there are several organizations that had to shut down because they were afraid that they would be prosecuted for helping sex workers.
For being traffickers themselves, right?
Exactly.
For providing
exactly.
food and shelter to sex workers. And then that, thus, in some of this legislation, makes you a trafficker.
Right. I mean, the people that can be attracted, right? If a sex worker has a kid, right, and then they, like, buy food for that kid, then that kid, you know, if you are, like, getting resources from the sex worker, you're a trafficker, right? So their own kid can be charged as their trafficker. Like,
or they can be charged as their own trafficker.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is, like, defies logic.
Yeah.
So you made this short film, and we'll put a link on it too. It's on wagingnonviolence.org. I want to just listen to a clip of it.
A lot of trans people are on our team because we believe in trans leadership.
Fundamentally, Southern Solidarity is an abolitionist group. That work is built on a legacy of Black organizing that has existed since the founding of this country.
We have a chance to change this space and be more mindful of people and more loving, not just on a surface level, and treat our community well, because so many of the tourists come here and they take, and then there's nothing left.
So I think the major cities in the United States have gotten the most press in terms of the uprisings, the protests, the marches. I think that to the sort of general citizen out there, when you ask them, like, where is the shit happening the most, they don't necessarily think of New Orleans. But New Orleans has this long history of protest and resistance. So tell me what you're trying to sort of achieve in this piece that you made.
I mean, I definitely am very excited by the history of organizing in New Orleans and by the present organizing in New Orleans. And in talking to these organizers, you know, it's really interesting how people brought up folks like Ruth Wilson Gilmore, who is a scholar and an abolitionist thinker, one of the founders of Critical Resistance, which has been talking about defunding police and abolishing prisons for over 20 years now. And, you know, talked about what they're doing as this like abolition democracy of building alternatives with this vision towards abolition. And so, you know, I think in this work, I'm just trying to lift the many people that are building in this proactive way. And trans folks are right now, they're almost done actually with fundraising, $400,000 to build housing for homeless trans folks, especially trans folks of color. And so people are really building these community alternatives. Just the other day, also people shut down the eviction courts. People went and stood in the way. And so the courts could not do any more evictions that day. And so I, like so many of your listeners, I'm sure, have been really excited by this movement in Minneapolis, in Los Angeles, where, as you know, I have a lot of community of resistance and I've spent a lot of time with folks there as well, and in Portland and Seattle and New York, but definitely New Orleans has been on these front lines as well. And I think in these front lines, in this context of, you know, of being a heart of white supremacy for so many centuries. I mean, our whole country is, right? But New Orleans, as being in the South, has faced it in a really special way.
You've been an activist for 20 years. You've been on the ground at countless crucial events all over the globe, from Hurricane Katrina to the Arab Spring. So, but you said you were hopeful at the beginning of this. Where is there hope for you? What do you imagine the next steps are going to be as the world, as we have known it, essentially ends?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to admit, but even more than 20 years, like, you know, some of my first activist meetings were actually ACT UP in New York in the 90s. And I remember going to those meetings, and they were in the Great Hall at Cooper Union, which for folks that are not New Yorkers, you know, might not know, but that seats several hundred people. And to go to activist meetings, there were like these weekly meetings with hundreds of people there, was a really incredible first exposure to organizing. And I think it helped me to see this vision of what's possible. And yeah, and I think that this pandemic moment has just shown that a different world is possible. I think that we are often stuck in this way of being, and we just don't think that another world is possible. You know, the policing in prisons as we know it, basically policing was founded partly out of slave catchers and also on the model of looking at colonial occupations like the US occupation of the Philippines and the British occupation of Ireland, right? That's the model of these policing systems. So that, you know, puts it at 150-ish years old. Prisons, similarly as we know them today, were basically founded, you know, after the end of slavery as this kind of continuation of slavery, right? So it's these systems that are 150 years old. It's not throughout human history. And yet it's hard for us to imagine being outside of it. And I think this moment where suddenly we didn't all have to go to work, although of course a lot of essential workers, food workers, other workers did have to, but that many of us did not have to go to work, showed us that our whole lives could be structured differently. And I think has allowed people to think about what else could be different and you know, what is really essential and what is really needed and how all of our well-being is tied up with each other, right? And that, you know, if there's COVID in prisons, it's going to be in the rest of our society. And like, and having places like prisons where COVID can outbreak makes all of us unsafe, right? Like these systems of capitalism, of patriarchy, of racism that we've been living around has made all of us unsafe. You know, we need universal healthcare. We need all these systems. And so I get, is this moment that has cracked things open and shown that other ways of doing things are possible.
But I think that also requires imagination, right? I think that's what I think some of the amazing like leaders of this movement have is an amazing imagination to imagine a future without police. You know, I think that's one of the first things when you hear defund the police or abolish the police, people are like, wait, but what about if someone commits a crime? What do we do with them, right? And what we have to do is like throw out all of what we think we know.
Yeah. Yeah,
and start
exactly
over.
Right. Yeah. And you know, there's been this real strain of like science fiction, this thread like of science fiction and organizing going together. I mean, the collection Octavia's Brood that I mentioned before that Walida and Marisha and Adrienne Marie Brown did, I think is a great example of it. But there's been so much of how people are looking at science fiction and organizing, and especially Black science fiction writers like Octavia Butler and organizers like Black Lives Matter movement as really tied up together.
To give us an outline of what the world could look like. Because just like Handmaid's Tale has given us a glimpse into a future, not one I want to go near at all. Yeah, there's this speculative fiction that has given us the glimpse of what could be.
Yeah, yeah, exactly right. People are building this world and folks like Leah Lakshmi, Peeps and Samara Singh, I think also, Mariam Kaba, you know, they've been looking at like for many years, these questions of how can we address harm in our communities without going to police? The Audre Lorde Project, I mean, first of all, just the work of Audre Lorde, but also Audre Lorde Project in New York, I think 15, 20 years ago now, had this program where they were building communities, places in the neighborhood where people could go if they were in danger instead of calling police, and people could call, and just building these structures of alternatives. So people have been building the world of tomorrow within today for many years.
And we as white people have to listen to those folks, especially,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah, yeah, we do.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for all the work you do. People don't know just what a badass you are, but they'll look you up on the internet. I mean, I could like just do like a 15-minute introduction about how much you've done. But thanks for having this conversation with me.
Thank you, Tristan. You know, I was wondering if this is going to be the episode after Stacey and Chin, because that's a really hard act to follow. I was listening to that.
It's not. I gave you a buffer.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. But I am so grateful for the work that you do and the voices that you lift up on your show. And I was really excited to hear Jean Denby, like I guess it was a couple months ago.
Yes.
That was like kind of the meeting of a couple of my favorite podcasts. That was really exciting.
Well, the book is called No More Heroes, Grassroots Responses to the Savior Mentality. It's published by AK Press. You can get it wherever you get books. I especially encourage you to support your local bookstores or independent bookstores, which you can do through bookshop.org. Jordan is online, sort of, at jordanflaherty.org, Flaherty. He is proud to say he is not on social media. And boy, am I totally with you on that right now. Want to thank my engineer and my editor, Aaron A-Rod Rodriguez. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. And in the meantime, thanks for hanging in there with me. Thanks for putting, you know, your ravenous desire to hear about sex for 1 hour. And until next time.